tape 81-1, 10 October, Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And the interviewer is Paul Cecil. This will be side one of tape one. Okay, for the record, give me your name and you are retired at the present time, right?
Right. This is Carl W. Marshall, retired Lieutenant Colonel. I retired in 1 September of 1970.
Okay. One other thing, too. This material is going in the archives, and so you understand the material will be made available for research.
Is that
all right with you? That
that's right. That's
okay.
Agreeable.
Okay, fine. Go ahead and start out when you started with the Langley Street Light.
I became associated with the Special Aerial Spray Flight in the early part of 1958. And as a result of having had some previous experience in Korea in 1952 of flying C-46s, dispersing DDT, I was assigned to the spray flight to utilize that experience. At that time, the...
When you were in Korea, was that the 505th?
Well, we were TDY out of a troop carrier unit out of Japan.
Oh, okay.
And this was an assignment that they had every summer during the hot months to go over and spray the troops.
Original mosquito bird.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
One interesting happening during that period of time was we actually sprayed Panmunjom with C-46s with, I think, F-84 top cover in case we were attacked in the process. And it was an agreeable thing between the two sides. It was, we had an understanding before we went up there, but we only sprayed it one time. They never did let us go back and do this again. But getting back to Langley, at that time we were assigned three C-47s. And another interesting fact is that that 510 that's in the museum over here is one of the original spray planes. Ben King was just telling me that. I didn't remember the tail number, but he said that's it.
That.
So we want to take a good look at that tomorrow.
It's appropriate that it's here then,
yeah.
Since it's original.
The configuration of spray that we had on the C-47s was only a wing boom, and we did not need the tail boom for the small coverage that we were applying, which was something in the range of 4 or 5 ounces per acre. I forget the exact figures. And we also had two L-20 Beaver aircraft, which were used for the pelletized spray. They could carry about 500 pounds in each aircraft.
And now, were all these sprays were primarily insecticide type?
Insecticide, right. We did not spray any herbicides at all in the U.S. Until later on in some experimental work that we did here in the Eglin complex. But it was all insecticides at that time. The spray flight itself, as far as the Air Force is concerned, was transferred to Langley in 1947 when the Air Force and the Army separated. It was moved to Langley and operated over the years up to that time.
Were under TAC control then, or?
We were under.
You mentioned something about DOD earlier.
In the base flight there at Langley was what was our support unit. We were just a part of that organization. But we operated under a Department of Defense regulation that we were just as obligated to support the Navy and Air Army and Marines as we were the Air Force. A lot of people didn't understand this fact, and we got into a lot of trouble over it because some of your Air Force people would come along and say, well, you can't do so-and-so, and if an Army base made a request for our services, we were obligated to fulfill it, and we did. We finally, you know, got it understood in the proper places, and we didn't have any more trouble along that line. But the C-47s were being gradually phased out of the Air Force in these years, and we could see the handwriting on the wall that we had to do something to have an airplane to perform the mission with. And due to the previous experience that I had in 119s, and the 123 is not really that much different in its configuration than 119, I felt like the 123 would make a suitable replacement for the 47 and the L-20. So we started researching the possibility of getting a 123 and equipping it with a liquid and a dry spray system. So we finally got it arranged to get a 123, and with in-house engineering from the Air Force, because of the financial situation, they wouldn't fund a civilian contractor to build such a system. So we had to more or less do it with what we could scrap up.
Jerry Reagan.
Well, as it turned out, we discovered that the Air Force had in stock some 1,000-gallon tanks that had been built for the Korean War under the Allied code. And we went out to Hill Air Force Base and looked at some of these tanks, and it was just what we wanted. So we made arrangements to have them declassified, and had several of them moved to Langley, and installed them in the first one in the 123 we had. And and the next part of the project was designing a hopper for the granular material, which would hold 10,000 pounds. And there was a problem with the weight and balance of trying to put the two systems in there at the same time. And after we got them installed, they took the airplane out to Wright-Patterson and run it through a test flight program, again with pilots. What I say again is with pilots that didn't know anything about spraying or what they were, and they put both the booms and the granular dispersal system on at the same time and tried to fly it that way, and it wouldn't fly. I mean, it wouldn't, you know, safely.
Slightly overweight. And
well, it didn't load it down to that extent, but the added drag from both systems was sufficient with what load it did put in there to put it into a dangerous flying configuration. But once we got that straightened out, then it turned out to be a satisfactory system. We had taken some commercial produced granular dispersal wings that had were designed for, you know, commercial aircraft, mm-hmm. and adapt them to the 123. No, have you seen any of those?
Mm-mm, no, I haven't.
I've got pictures at home of some of those that I can send you some information,
yes,
on that,
yes,
kind of stuff.
And yes, you'll get a letter that's going to tell you where to send and the address and everything.
All right, well, I can do that. And in fact, I got a lot of pictures and things of, you know, things that you probably never see.
Okay,
so
yeah,
I'll try,
sure,
to get you all that information,
okay,
I can.
Well, by the way, while we're interrupted here, you mentioned the hourglass tanks from the Korean project. Ironically, you were getting them to do an insecticide mission, but the original design of those hourglass was for a herbicide mission in Korea that was aborted, right?
It was basically the same mission that we were flying, that we wound up flying in Vietnam, is what they had designed these tanks for in the Korean situation.
At that time, they didn't have a herbicide that would react.
And another interesting fact is the chemical that was produced and shipped to Washington that the military bought, it stayed in storage up there for a period of time, and I won't guarantee this information is correct, but I suspect it is. The manufacturers bought that material back as surplus material, reproduced it, reprocessed it, and sold it back to the military again.
I can believe that happening.
Well, I'm satisfied that it's true that happened, because they had thousands and thousands of gallons of up there.
But the project was never actually used in Korea.
No, it never even left the States.
Never left the States.
It was ready to go. And
it's mine.
But they didn't. They never left the States.
Okay, no, that one's mine because they're prescription.
So are these.
Oh.
Five four.
But getting back to Langley, we eventually secured three C-123s and retired the three Goonie Birds and the two L-20s. And we got some new personnel in that were experienced in M-123 operation, which that was another problem we had to train personnel into a different airplane, flying it plus the spraying with it.
And you didn't have that many personnel in the spray flight in the first place, right?
No, we only had five pilots. At the time we had the three C-47s and two L-20s. So we couldn't fly all of our airplanes at one time without borrowing somebody else.
A pilot's dream.
Well, it was no shortage of flying if anybody wanted to fly. There was plenty of opportunity. But during all of this changeover from the Goonie Birds and L-20s to the 123, Captain Frank Dowell, who was the entomologist with us, made a survey of all of the routine spray operations that had been going on for several years, and we eliminated, with the agreement of the various services involved, some of the marginal operations that we were performing, and tried to only service those that were really had a legitimate need. So this made the project much more worthwhile in the sense that it was doing a necessary job instead of just spraying places that just a few people were benefiting from. Some of the radar sites or things that maybe had half a dozen people out there and spending several $1,000 to just relieve them of a little mosquito irritation was too expensive, and we tried to eliminate and did as many of those type situations as we could. We expanded in some areas. We had missions even in Alaska. We started getting requests from bases up there. And we had several missions to go up into the upper part of Alaska and spray Dakotas, California, or not California, they were very particular about spraying, but Arizona.
Still are.
I sprayed one mission in Yuma, Arizona, and the morning that I was out there spraying, I could see an inspector. We was right on the state line, and he was standing over there watching every time we did, just waiting for us to spray a little bit into California. We didn't have any problem with that. But most of our missions were basically up and down the East Coast, Langley and all the way up New York, in Massachusetts. Fort Devon, Massachusetts was one of the bases that was sprayed pretty regular. A lot of bases in Florida, in the Carolinas. And so this, your salt marsh mosquito was the big enemy as far as we were concerned at that time. Along came the fire ant problem in the South. And we got involved with quite a few missions because of our granular spray capability. We got into the Department of Agriculture operation, and we sprayed most of the larger army reservations in South Carolina, Georgia, just about all over the South. And of course, that's to evaluate something like that is very difficult because, you know, you don't spray and kill them all, they can reinfest an area very, very rapidly. But that was one of our big missions for quite a while, was putting out the granular material. Of course, with insecticides at that time, and I'm sure still true today, you can put it in either, you know, pelletized or liquid form. It just depends on the application that you want to make as to what you want to do with it. We had contact with, you know, civilian agencies, and we got a lot of help from them, and they in turn, got a lot of help from us. Of course, we didn't spray too many civilian areas. Langley was probably the biggest civilian area that we sprayed in connection with the military.
But the U.S. Health Service could request the DOD.
Well, I suppose they could, but really we never got, request from them directly. It was more military, except for the Department of Agriculture in the fire ant program. That was the main thing beside the liquid sprays. So. But along about the middle of 61, when Vietnam was beginning to heat up, we had been hearing rumors about the possibility of some spraying being required. And it was I believe his name was Dr. Rogers that was involved with it. You may know, you may have some information that would tell you who this was, and I believe it was Rogers.
There was a Brown involved too.
Well, maybe it's Brown I'm thinking about. Yeah. Yeah, I believe it is Brown. But anyway, I don't know if he called me or what, before we'd ever been requested to get involved in it. And he said something about taking 119s to Vietnam to spray. Because, see, this hourglass unit, when they built it, the 123 wasn't in existence, so the configuration was made for 119s and for bombers and other types of aircraft, but not for the 123. So I explained to him, you know, that the 119s were pretty well phased out of the system at the time, and it was using the 123. And he didn't want to believe that at first, you know. He didn't think the 123 would do the job. So we finally convinced him that, you know, it was going to be 123s or nothing.
And you'd been using the 123 now for a couple of years.
We had.
So wasn't it something brand new?
No.
Okay.
No, we've been using the 123 enough to, you know its capability. And let me back up a minute. When we designed the capability of the airplane as far as the liquid system was concerned, we went to every agency that would ever have a potential use of it and said, what is the maximum amount of material that you feel like this system should be able to do? And they said a gallon to the acre is the most that you'll ever have to, you know, put out. So that was what was designed into the system.
That was
put
your
out
criteria.
A gallon to the acre was the maximum. Well, I'll explain later on about the situation in Vietnam, but in talking with Dr. Brown, assuming that's who he was, you can check that later.
Yeah.
But we, you know, sort of put two and two together that what was coming up, and the talk around the around TAC was that they were going to send a unit over there. And at the time, we probably had about 8 pilots and enlisted personnel, probably in the range of 25 or 30 people. I don't remember the exact numbers. But I had received orders to ship out to the Azores to be a liaison officer at Lodges, and already had a seat on an airplane to leave in the date. And I was contacted by a man from TAC headquarters to want to know if I would take this unit to Vietnam and perform this mission, which originally was a 90-day TDY operation. This Dr. Brown had been talking to some of the people that within that period of time that we could spray just about all of Vietnam and be back home. Well, the original TDY orders were cut for 90 days. So as it developed, I told them that I would go, and they canceled my other orders and wrote some new orders to go to Vietnam, and we had to get some additional airplanes, and it just so happened to have been some of the 123s that were designed with navigator stations built in. So they got 6 of those airplanes, and in a hurry-up configuration change, installed spray systems in those 6 later model 123s.
And they picked these up from the resources at Pope?
Right. They were drawn from the Pope squadrons. And they searched around for the armor plating that was designed and delivered with the original airplane, but it had since been salvaged and sold for scrap, since it had been there for years and, you know, didn't utilize it, so they figured they'd never need it. So they had to go real quick and make some new stuff and install it in the airplanes. But in the process of their installing the equipment and gathering up the personnel, we got what additional personnel we needed from the 123 unit at Pope, along with the pilots and all the other support personnel.
Were all these volunteers? Or?
Yes, everybody had to sign a statement that they we don't volunteer. And,
okay.
And we went through the briefing that anything happened to us, you know, that our families would be taken care of, and that we were not to be identified as being military personnel if we were captured or killed or whatever.
In other words, you're going to go over there as civilians, effectively.
No,
as far as the outside.
That had been discussed, but they had discarded that idea, and we went as military. But still, you know, there was that stipulation that they wouldn't claim us if we got captured. But we got everything together, and we departed, and it was just a day or two before Thanksgiving when we was supposed supposed to go, and they changed the rule, the release order, and we left the day after Thanksgiving. They let us stay that extra day or two. And but they were so anxious for us to go. We, you know, cut every corner we could to get off and get over there. They had installed, reinstalled the wingtip tanks, which were not normal, you know, on the airplanes. They didn't use them in the normal troop carrier operation. And we had installed those, and of course we didn't have any experience with it, that extra fuel system. That was new to us. And so just to check them out, we flew nonstop from Hope to California to try the new system out. Another problem we had was the oil. There was no oil gauges on 123s, so there was no way of telling when you were running low of oil. So the system was worked out that for every hour of flight, it just automatically pumped in a gallon of oil to the tanks to keep them supplied, and it turned out to be a satisfactory system. We didn't have any trouble in that area. But in the flight from California to Hickam, we had several navigators who were not too well experienced, so we paired them up with the ones who had the experience with the junior officers, and we said if anybody had to abort, well, we had them in partners. So the airplane, we was in the lead plane, and one of my wingmen started icing up. He took off, and he decided that he wasn't going to make it, so he aborted. Well, he was paired up with the other wingman, so he went back, and so they had to take off and come the next day. But we went on just single airplane, and then I believe it was 15-minute interval that second element took off and followed us. So the four of us arrived in Hickam without any difficulty. It was kind of scary at first to watch that fuel consumption. You know, when you're loaded and think you'll never make it. But it took us 16 and a half hours to.
Did you know Adams, Captain Adams?
George Adams?
George Adams.
Oh, yeah.
You gotta let him read that.
He knows about the Adams manuscript.
He's just. I just finished reading it right there.
I was one of
the same missions that you.
Got Adams to consolidate that information.
Yeah.
And he was still working for me when he did that. But we went on across from Hickam to Johnson Island to Guam to the Philippines. And we arrived in at Clark. We were.
By the way, you weren't carrying your own support equipment, were you? Didn't they set that over on 124s?
Yeah, we had a 124 that was following us with the XP engine and support personnel to get us over there.
They said the 124s had a little problem.
Well, they did.
Getting along with you.
Well, they kind of, you know, acted as a mother support in flying across with us.
Yeah.
And of course we couldn't carry anything other than fuel, and us was all that was capable of carrying. And it was just almost beyond the capability of 123 to fly across there.
We're
just stretching the limit to go 2,000
miles. A lot of wet out there.
2,200 miles with a you know, with that smaller airplane and fuel you could carry. Because we used the spray tank as an auxiliary fuel system. We had 1,000 gallons of fuel in it and had it tied into a system we could pump it into the tanks. And which was the only way we could go. We didn't have enough otherwise. But we didn't lose any airplanes that, you know, under those, for those reasons. But we arrived at Clark, and we got settled down there, waiting on orders to go into Vietnam, and discover the fact that the chemical that we were going to spray had been shipped by boat about the same time that we left, and scheduled 30 days en route to Vietnam. And so we had to sit at Clark and wait for the chemical to arrive. And there was talk about the fear of spraying a chemical to begin with because of the propaganda of our side using chemical warfare and all of that hullabaloo. But in fact, I had a bet with one of the staff officers at Clark headquarters that he said we'd never spray a drop of it when we got over there. And so I bet him we would, and I never did go back. I bet him a fifth of whiskey, and I never did go back to collect.
He told you.
Yeah. But the chemical arrived, and we moved three airplanes in the first week in January of 62 into Saigon. And
you didn't go over there in November of 61?
No, not we. We didn't get, some of our airplane crews went on routine missions over to Saigon, but the first
herbicide
mission of 123s went in January of 62. A little interesting sidelight. They were running, and I believe this Dr. Brown was involved in this, some test flights in C-47s using a Vietnamese C-47 back, you know, a few months before this. In fact, Captain Kadori, who had been one of my spray pilots at Langley, had been shipped to Korea on a, you know, different, you know, just flying routine C-47 operations. And when this test program come up, they wanted us, the spray flight, to send a pilot over there to fly these test missions. And I told them, I said, you've got a man sitting up there in Korea who's just come out of this unit, who's well qualified to do that job. Well, he was sent TDY from Korea down to Saigon and flew these test missions in C-47. Sergeant Rowe from our unit in Langley went over that TDY to install. In fact, we shipped them one of our old systems that we had taken out of the C-47. And it was interesting that we had mainly been spraying malathion in this system. And it's a foul-smelling chemical. Well, they crated it up and put it on a cargo plane and shipped it. And when it got to California, those people refused to haul it because it smelled so bad. they had to uncrate it and steam clean it and recrate it before they had hauled it. But it finally arrived in Saigon, and Sergeant Rowe helped them install the system. And that whole system had a capability, as I remember, of about a third of a gallon per acre was about all it would put out, which
wasn't,
well, yeah, but it wasn't enough for this particular type of mission. And but they sprayed some areas and killed some vegetation with what they had, and was, you know, we're satisfied with it. So we, after, in fact, the Dory was still there when we arrived in January of 62. I think he's He stayed over there another month or two. I don't remember exactly how long. But he finally went back to Korea and finished his tour and came on home. But when we got the first three airplanes there in Saigon, we still, all of our orders were coming direct out of Washington that would tell us what we could do and what we couldn't do. And we, of course, had routine flying around there. We tried to fly each plane about 2 hours a day just to keep the crews from getting too bored and, you know, keep the maintenance people busy. And I don't remember the exact date that we lost that airplane that two pilots were out, you know, flying just a routine practice spray mission. And
they used water in
well,
the
Well, it was, no, just flying the pattern. It was, there was no,
not really spraying
no spray material on board. In fact, the airplane only had a very light fuel load, and we just never could understand their crashing. There just was no reason for it that we could see.
Did anybody ever get any ground fire on these practice?
Not that we know of. The rumors that we got were that they wouldn't fire at you because, you know, they didn't know who we were and didn't know, in other words, they would be revealing their position if they fired on us, and they didn't want to do it at that time. The VC wasn't established, sufficiently to be that open about firing. So we never received any problem in that area at that time.
Now, were you, while you were there initially, was this in any way associated with the Dirty 30 or the mule train operations?
Later on, we got involved with the mule train because the commanders at Saigon, you know, just didn't like to see these airplanes flying around empty, burning up fuel, and when they had cargo to haul, you know, after the outline basis. And we argued and argued and argued to keep them from forcing us into hauling cargo because we didn't want to do it. We didn't have loadmasters. We wasn't equipped, in a sense, to, you know, to be cargo handlers.
And particularly trained in some
Well, way. I had personally, you know, flown 119s, yeah. And there was no problem. And of course, these pilots had come out of a cargo
carrying boat.
Organization, so that part of it was, you know, no problem. But we didn't want to do it. We went over there to spray herbicide, and we didn't want to get involved in hauling cargo. But we were overruled and forced into it. Took our spray tanks out and started hauling cargo. And and we lost another airplane hauling cargo by going into the wrong field and attempting to take off and on too short a runway.
But you didn't lose the crew on that?
No, we didn't lose the crew.
The first one you lost two crew members and the plane.
And that's right. We lost two pilots and the engineer on the first airplane, and then lost the airplane on the second.
Now, did you replace these out of the ones left at that?
Right. When we lost that first airplane, well, they brought over, you know, one to replace that out of the three at Clark. And not too long after that, they allowed us to get the other two airplanes on over there. So we had five and then got into the cargo hauling and we lost that one. So we didn't have the four. But as I said before, they had originally sent us over there for 90 days TDY. Well, they extended that another 90 days and for everybody. We had a few people that had personal problems and we, you know, allowed them to come back home before their TDY was up. But for the most part, the whole group stayed through the second 90 day.
When you say roughly how many people are we talking
about? We had approximately 70 people. And this was was something that we ran into, that I ran into a tremendous problem on, because we were just a TDY unit. We were not set up as a full operating squadron, which is what those people looked at us as being. They thought we had all of the regulations and the whole nine yards of that a normal administrative squadron would have, which you don't carry along that kind of stuff on a TDY mission. And I got in a lot of hot water over that. The colonels would come down there and shoot me out because I didn't do so and so. And in fact, I forgot not who it was, but some guy over there wrote an efficiency rating on me. Got that report and he just tore it up and wrote his own. But I don't remember. I'm sure it's in the record somewhere. We eventually got approval to do some test spraying. And what I mean by test spraying is, in Vietnam, there was hundreds of different varieties of vegetation, from the mangrove swamps to the tall timbers in the mountain. And they didn't know exactly the full effect that the chemical was going to have on, you know, the various vegetations. So we selected different areas to represent these varying varieties and set up test plots. And we went out and sprayed these areas. And then they went back and, checked them on the ground.
Now, this is ground and agriculture.
Yeah, that's right. To see if we were putting out, enough chemical and all the ramifications of it. Well, the mangrove swamp, that type of vegetation, it was real effective, and showed up fairly rapidly on that type of stuff. But you get into the tall timber area, in some places you'd have as many as three and four different canopies in there. You had your low scrub brush and then a higher, maybe 10 or 15 feet, and then higher, and then your big trees. Well, this chemical is such that you had to get some of it on every individual growth in order for it to have an effect on the variety of vegetation.
Let me stop you here while I turn the thing.